This is the Lascalzo Institute Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of May the 8th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and the Lascalzo Institute. This week, we're going to take a look at developments that took place over the week, many of which, interestingly enough, came up in the area of healthcare. You might have read a little bit about that in the news this week, heard some of those things happening. Well, the IRS has developments in healthcare, and Congress has some developments here. So what we're going to look at this week, we'll talk about the IRS issuing a set of numbers, a couple of sets of numbers that deal with healthcare in 2018. Some of the numbers may never actually matter, but we'll talk about them anyway. The IRS ruled on a North Saw spinoff, and that's a type of a spinoff under 355 that the IRS had put on their no rule list back in 2013. This week, they came out and told us what they think about such transactions. We have the tax court telling us what a tax refund is. That ended up being a discussion and a key issue in a case in front of the court. We have a laboratory that was ruled to not be a healthcare business for purposes of the 1202 rules, and that's actually good news for the healthcare provider in this case. And finally, we're going to look at the interaction of the penalty provisions under 6662, which are the accuracy penalties, and a partnership, which is subject to the TEFRA exam rules, and dealing with the problem of the consistent reporting rules. If a taxpayer doesn't report under the consistent reporting rules, can the IRS actually penalize that taxpayer directly, or do they actually have to go through the partnership and open up a TEFRA exam in order to be able to do any penalties in this area? We'll talk about all of that this week, because all of those are things that came up this week in the developments that we had for taxes. Well, we're getting around to actually starting doing some courses now, so I thought I'd let you know, those of you in Massachusetts, Don Cochran's going to be up in Massachusetts, Wakefield, Massachusetts, on the 23rd and 24th of this month. On the 23rd, he'll be doing a course on construction contractors. This is a combination tax and accounting course. So 4 hours tax, 4 hours A&A. That course goes on, talks about all the interesting things with contractors, including, as we all know, the new revenue recognition standard on the A&A side. And then on the 24th, he'll be dealing a session with advanced tax updates. And that particular course deals with the updates, the kind of things we talk about here. We're going to be focused primarily on those things of interest to people who have many years of experience and who are doing a lot of tax planning. So we won't spend much time on talking about things like, you know, what the exemption rates are going to be for the following year, or, you know, all those various, you know, change numbers that you can easily grab if you have experience, you know what those are. Talk about more interesting developments. If you're in the area and you want to sign up for those courses here later in the month, go to the Massachusetts website at mscpaonline.org, check out the continuing education section, and you'll be able to find your courses there that you'll be able to work on, get both of these courses, plus check the Massachusetts Society's other courses being held during the year, both those put on by us here at the Lascalzo Institute and those put on by other presenters. Let's go and take a look now at the actual developments for the week. And we're going to start out with all of the neat healthcare things. Well, you probably all heard this, that the House of Representatives passed the American Healthcare Act. They did it by the narrowest of margins. They needed 216 votes to pass it. They ended up passing it with 217 just before they left town. So it's passed. Now, as we've talked about before, there are tax provisions in the AHCA. As far as we can tell at this point, and again, this bill was changing rapidly, but as far as we can tell at this point, none of the healthcare provisions were changed. No, I should say if the tax provisions were changed, the healthcare provisions were. But the tax provisions weren't changed. So we talked about a few weeks ago about the tax rules in the healthcare bill. Those tax rules are still part of this. The catch is, of course, though, while that's all well and good, this bill goes on to the Senate. And it's not at all clear what the Senate's going to do. Remember, we had the Republicans had a much larger majority, shall we say, percentage-wise to deal with in the House, and the bill barely squeaked by. In the Senate, they've only got two votes to spare. They can lose two yes votes, presuming the Democrats will vote no. There's a lot of people believe that there will be significant changes made to this bill in the Senate. Then the fun becomes after the Senate. So if you have that, the next piece of fun is, we, as you're pretty much aware from tax bills, always, we end up with a conference committee. So what finally ends up being the bill may very well be radically different from what we have now, or potentially it may just not be a doable thing. In any event, all we can tell you for sure is to watch now. So for the interim, while all this is going on, the Affordable Care Act's rules remain for now. And that means that we have to consider the possibility the Affordable Care Act will continue to be the law for a period of time that is an unknowable period. Potentially, it will just simply always continue to be the law. Depends upon if they can get this through the Congress or not and in what shape they get it through. Now, the Affordable Care Act, of course, has a number of provisions in it that are inflation adjusted, and it's a time of year to start publishing those things for healthcare. So the IRS did issue the 2018 ACA numbers. If these matter, we know what they are. It's in Revenue Procedure 2017-36. This includes the applicable percentage table. That is what's used to determine how much of a credit you can get under the Affordable Care Act. That's the percentage of your household income that you need to spend toward buying health care. If you remember how the bill works, that number is compared with the cost of the second highest, or I should say the second lowest cost silver policy. And whatever that difference is, let's say if the second highest cost silver policy costs $100 more per month than your percentage of income based on this table, then you get a credit for the difference between that percentage of income you're supposed to spend and the second highest cost silver policy. You can then use that credit on any policy, but you don't get it. If you pay less than the second highest cost silver policy, you get less credit. If you pay more, you still get only that credit to the second highest cost silver policy. Those percentages, we've been working with them if you've had the credit for a past couple of years, and those are in the table that you'll find in the materials we have here. They'll run from 2.01% to somebody below 133% of the federal poverty line, all the way up to 9.56% when we get to above 300%, but not more than 400% of the federal poverty line. Those are the income percentages we're using. The other rules we're going to be using here is we have the employer affordability number that also will be at 9.56. This is determining whether a taxpayer was offered affordable coverage for purposes of whether they can qualify for the credit. So that's the idea. If you're offered affordable coverage by your employer, then you're not eligible for the credit, effectively in that case. And finally, there'll be the percentage of household income that's used to determine if the household qualifies for the exception from having to pay the penalty for not having health care coverage. That penalty, that amount will be 8.05%. So if you're above that, if you have to pay more than 8.05%, then that's considered to be unaffordable. Therefore, you can skip the penalty. Now, as we said, that's interesting, but we don't know for sure that those rules are going to stay in place. In fact, obviously, there's a move afoot to try to change these rules. But one thing there's not a move afoot to change is the issue of health savings accounts. Health savings accounts represent a health care tax planning option. And the nice thing about them at this point is they're basically probably still going to be around. Note as well, the high deductibles, when HSAs first were brought into the law, those deductible amounts seemed to be very high compared to what a lot of people had as coverage. Now these days, those high deductibles don't appear so high anymore. In fact, a whole lot of policies now are written where their deductibles are at least that level. That opens up HSAs to a lot of people. And there's no current proposals out there to cut back or eliminate HSAs. So unlike the thing we just talked about here with the Affordable Care Act percentages and numbers, in this case, we have something that apparently will still be around. You know, we can count on it for 2018. And because of that, we just got the numbers for 2018's limits on HSAs. So for 2018, now again, this is not 17, this is 18. These numbers jump slightly from 17. Revenue Procedure 2016-28 issued on May the 4th. The contribution limits for HSAs next year for an individual who has self-only coverage under a high deductible health plan and no other disqualifying coverage will be $3,450. For family coverage, that is, it covers you and at least one other member of the family, that contribution limit will be at $6,900. Now remember, HSAs, which was what's always nice about them compared to the old MSAs, your contribution is not limited solely to what the deductible is. So even if you have a deductible that is below those max funding limits, you can still fund up to those limits. Well, the HSAs required you to reduce your funding based on what your deductible was. Speaking of deductibles, that minimum deductible for next year will be $1,350 for a self-only policy, and it'll be $2,700 for a family policy. Finally, those policies to be a qualified HDHP policy, the out-of-pocket cost must be limited to $6,650 for self-only coverage and $13,300 for family coverage. Those numbers had, for all practical purposes, become less important because under the Affordable Care Act, policies had to have a max, number, a max out-of-pocket number that was essentially at those levels. If, in fact, though, we get the repeal of the ACA, depending on how that's taken into account, then we may be back to where high deductible plans will now, you'll have to check a plan to make sure that its stop loss number is at a high enough level. It's basically is at a level that's not above the level here. Presumably, under the bill, under the Affordable Health Care Act as passed by the House, it would appear that if a state opted out, they would be able to allow an insurer to sell a policy that didn't have a cap at that level. That just means it would take a little more care for clients to make sure they're selecting a true high deductible healthcare policy, not one that will be disqualified because it doesn't have a stop loss level at the right level. Well, now we'll leave tax care. We're going to go talk about a transaction the IRS did or a ruling the IRS did that's something that they had kind of put on a we don't know how this works list and has been sitting there in limbo for 4 years. The catch we've got here, we're going to talk about this a bit later, but let's talk a little background about the problem of the step transaction doctrine. If we have a series of transactions that lead to a tax result by taking each one separately, but that if we actually did this all as one complete just one transaction at the same time, you get a different tax result, that often causes the IRS to bring up what's called the step transaction doctrine. Those linked transactions are collapsed by the IRS when a taxpayer tries it, so that the IRS will claim that, well, I don't care that you say this particular piece of the transaction qualifies under X, and then we do this next thing that qualifies under Y, but if we had gone straight from the beginning condition to the end condition, it would have been a taxable event, but if we do these two, it won't. Quite often with the step transaction doctrine, the IRS basically shuts that down. In this case, we're going to see, one of the tests they use is what's called the but-for test. We would not have done step X, the initial step, and step Y. We would not have done step X except for the fact we knew we were doing step Y. So the but-for test takes a look at, basically, are these really two independent transactions, each of which stands alone and each of which would have been done regardless of the other? Or in fact, is there no way we would have done either transaction unless we could do both of them and get the tax benefit that was asked for? So the but-for test is big, and that was the concern that people had in the area that we're going to talk about today. But the interesting part this ruling points out, and a lot of people were surprised, we discovered that the IRS in this ruling announced that we're not always going to necessarily just do a but-for test. In this case, we're looking at a situation that's a corporate situation, an attempt to do what's essentially spin out, do a spin-off, I should say, of a business that's being conducted by a subsidiary of a subsidiary. It's referred to as a north-south spinoff. And there was concern about how that would go. Let's talk about the north-south spinoff here for just a second. The transaction in question was discussed in Revenue Ruling 2017-9, issued on May the 3rd. The transaction in question is we have a parent company. The parent company owns a subsidiary. That subsidiary owns 100% of another subsidiary. So for purposes of the illustration, the IRS calls the parent P. P stands for parent, right? We call the subsidiary that the parent owns directly D, because we're going to discover that's going to be the distributing entity. So that's D. And then we call the subsidiary of the subsidiary. Remember, the parent has no direct ownership of it. It owns the company. It owns the corporation that owns this other corporation. We call that C. C has an operating business it's been conducting for at least 5 years. It's called business B in the example, if you want to follow the example. The parent company also has at least one business that it's been actively conducting for at least 5 years. That's business A. And these businesses are actively conducted as it matters for Section 355. What we want to do is we want to transfer the stock in C to the parent. We want to try to do that by using 355's ability to essentially divide a corporation tax-free into multiple pieces by splitting it apart. But to do that in 355, you have to basically split the corporation into two corporations, each one of which gets a business that has been that was actively conducted by the old company for at least 5 years. And the problem we have here is D, our distributing company, has no active trader business. May have various other things, but has nothing that qualifies under the five-year test of 355. So our problem is, and if you actually follow this, it makes some sense. We can't really easily get that stock from the subsidiary of the subsidiary to the parent. And we could obviously liquidate our subsidiary D into the parent, but we may not want to do that. You know, we may have various reasons why we want to keep whatever is in D and separate it. You know, so we don't have any good way. 351 allows us to push things from the parent to D, but there's no easy equivalent thing that's going to let us push it from D to the parent, because what's going to happen there is that's going to be a distribution of appreciated asset to a shareholder, and the consolidated rules don't give us any good way of having that happen without triggering the tax to distributing corporation. So here's the proposed transaction. We're going to do what's going to be called a pair of transactions, taking advantage of things we can do. So what's going to happen is the parent company is going to take that at least an operating business that it has and it runs on its own. The parent's going to move that business into distributing D. It does so under 351. Under 351, it can do so tax-free. Okay, all well. So there's a 351. We've now moved a business into D. It inherits all the attributes that parent had, so that 5 years is going to come with it. Okay. Now, we do a second transaction. We now take the stock of C, and we now we do the 355 transaction, divide D into the everything else except for C, which includes this operating business. Therefore, D now has an operating business, so let the 355 work, and push the second operating business, which is C, back to the parent, which is our shareholder. That's no problem. The question is, can we do that without the IRS collapsing it into simply a sale of the C stock to the parent for the value of the business? The bad news there is you would have a sale for 25% recognized by D. The parent would also have to recognize gain on the asset it sold, on the business it sold. And then D would have to recognize gain either due to the sale for the 25% or distributing appreciated assets. It's going to be a problem. So the question is, which one is it? And the IRS in this case actually did something that surprised a few people. The IRS did not apply the step transaction doctrine. It looked effectively to see whether each of the interim transactions had stuff, you know, was something Congress intended to happen. And did it appear that that intent took place? You know, did something really happen at each step? And that's an interesting view. Now, the real question is going to become, will the IRS expand this view to other transactions, or is this something specifically just for this area? But the good news for those people that are in C corporation taxation issues and who may have this problem of having and have worried about wanting to do a north-south transaction, but we just didn't know how they worked, now at least we have some IRS assurance about how they work, which I guess we'll call a good thing. Next up, the case of, and I apologize to this poor person, Sotiriopoulos versus Commissioner. We're going to talk about the foreign tax credit in this case. Now, the foreign tax credit's great. It allows us to, if we're going to be subject to tax by one country, let's say the United Kingdom, and we also have to pay that tax to the U.S. because we're a U.S. citizen, The foreign tax credit allows us not have to pay two levels of tax. That's great. Helps us. So we get that. We reduce our U.S. tax based on the foreign tax paid. However, if we later receive a refund of that tax, the law very specifically requires that we have to notify the IRS of that refund and file an amended return. By the way, this particular rule also opens up the statute. So it doesn't matter if you get your refund 10 years later, you got to go back and fix that return from 10 years ago. You have to do that. It's totally separate and apart from the standard statute. So it works for this point. But now the question is going to become, and our key definition problem here is, you know, what's a refund? Big thing to notice, the foreign tax credit simply does not work if you don't pay the tax to the foreign country in the year in which you recognize the income to the United States. So if we pay the tax in a later year and we don't have any foreign income in that year, the credit gets lost. And in this case, we're going to take a look at a situation where the taxpayer ran into an issue. Again, the case Sortiropoulos versus Commissioner, I apologize totally to mispronouncing that name. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-75 issued on May 1st. In this case, this particular taxpayer working in the United Kingdom was subject to the United Kingdom's income tax, and she had taxes withheld from her wages, fairly substantial taxes. She took the U.S. foreign tax credit based on that withholding. However, she went out and bought a number of what the U.K. viewed as tax shelters to wipe out her U.K. tax. So after buying those, she filed claims for refund with the UK and received a refund of those taxes. Now, the UK government, not surprisingly, not very different from the US government, sometimes questions whether tax shelters work. And in this case, the UK government is actively investigating, and she's been told by counsel it's likely she's going to have to repay those taxes. But in any event, she knew when she got the refund, there was a chance she'd have to repay the taxes. In this case, she never told the IRS about her refund. She kept that quiet. IRS discovers the refund. Now the question becomes, does she have to go back and do the recalculation? She argues two things to say why she shouldn't have to deal with that recalculation. She argued first that, well, I might have to pay that tax back. The UK government could demand the tax back from me. The tax court said, well, let's look at the definition. The law says refund. What does refund mean? And the court said, you know, refund for this purpose should have the same definition as refund generally has under U.S. taxes for refunds of U.S. taxes. A whole bunch of your clients this year filed tax returns and they got federal tax refunds, right? That's what you called them. That's what they call them. But we all know that the IRS has the three-year statute to go back, examine those returns, and potentially demand some or all of that refund back, potentially tell them they owe even more tax. The tax court said, that's a refund, and you know what? What you're telling me about the UK is still the same thing. You got a refund. You got money back that you had paid as tax. You took a foreign tax credit for it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a refund. Okay, the taxpayer had a second idea. Okay, let's accept that. But here's my problem. If I pay that money back, I'm going to get no tax benefit. She says, you know, basically. Now, the court doesn't describe why she'd get no tax benefit, but it seems fairly plausible that here's your trouble. She's no longer in the UK. She has no UK source income. Or she's going to end up with so much tax it won't matter. So all this UK income's not there. She comes back to the U.S. with no foreign source income. She pays all this tax to the U.K. When you do the math, you know, the credit's based upon, you know, how much you had double taxed income. She has no double taxed income this year. Her double taxed income was back in the prior year, and the law doesn't allow you to go back and amend that prior year if you pay the foreign country. Different problem. So she claimed, look, I get no tax benefit. It's just unfair to force me to pay this until the time period expires for the UK to recover the tax. Because I'll have to pay it back, then, you know, I'll have to pay tax to the US, losing my benefit for the foreign tax credit for the taxes. And then I go back, restore them again, and I can't get that money back from the IRS. Tax court said, tough luck. Things like that happen to people. Timing issues, there's all kinds of reasons why you cannot. This is not the same thing as a state tax refund that we're taxing the following year. This, you're saying, don't tax me today because it's possible I might not get a tax benefit if I have to pay it back. Of course, not going to allow that might be possible argument. Next up, going to talk about here a special case dealing with the Section 1202 exclusion for sale on stock gains in certain cases. 1202 is wonderful. It can result in a tax-free sale of S corporation stock, or I should say of corporate stock. But it has to be a C corp, has to be a small C corp. If you have a qualifying stock of that sort, then effectively the good news is you don't pay tax when you sell that stock. If you can sell that stock down the line, or even if you liquidate the company, that could be a huge advantage to being a C corporation. But a key limitation is certain businesses don't qualify for 1202 status. The question we have in today's case was, in this ruling, did this particular business, was it a disqualified business? And the case we're going to look at today is a private letter ruling that the IRS got, they issued this week. This is private letter ruling 2017-17010. In this case, this was a lab that performed testing for a specific health issue. They did not meet with the patients. They did not issue diagnoses. Rather, a healthcare provider would contract with them, and then they would give the results back to the healthcare provider, but they didn't talk directly to patients. They ask, and now their company had been sold. They want to have this large exclusion from tax, which is a very nice thing to have. So they were arguing, you know, are we a healthcare company? The IRS in this case ruled this is not a healthcare company. That because effectively it never dealt with, there were two key things. It never dealt with patients. So it never talked to patients directly and it never created a diagnosis. Now we don't know if both of those are necessary and that if you had some, if you had a lab that let's say did talk with the patients, you know, sold directly to patients, whether that would kill it, even if they, quote, didn't give a diagnosis, but said, go see your doctor. Or conversely, if they actually did the diagnosis, which would probably be unlikely, but let's say they did for the physician, but didn't talk to patients, would that clobber it? Nevertheless, it does tell us something because we don't have a whole lot of rulings about what exactly is or is not a qualified business for 1202 purposes. So you might start considering that, and we've got the list in our materials on the website this week of all the disqualified businesses. It's certainly something you got to be able to defend down the line about why you didn't advise an entity to be a C corp, especially if the stock gets sold down the line, because if the stock sold, that whole double tax thing went away, and potentially this tax could have been skipped too. So there's a reason why, if they're going to be able to sell the stock down the line, 1202 may make sense. Obviously, if you have a situation where you're going to take a company public is the expectation, then clearly that's a case you're going to sell stock. But it also works in other situations. So just be aware and take a look at the definitions here. Some businesses may qualify, you might not have thought would qualify. Finally, we're going to talk a little bit about partnerships today. Under the TEFRA rules, and this will also be true under the Budget Act of 2015's rules, you have to report consistently with a covered partnership under the consolidated rules. So if I get a K-1, if I'm a partner in a partnership that is subject to the consolidated audit rules, whether they are the TEFRA rules or whether they are the Bipartisan Budget Act rules that will take effect for partnerships years beginning after January 1st of 2017 or 2018, they'll take place after those first days. You still need to report consistently. If you get a K-1, you either have to report consistently with what the partnership said, or you have to file a statement indicating why you're not reporting consistently. If you fail to report, the catch is, well, that's fine. The IRS is able to just math adjust and put it back on your return. But now a question comes, what about penalties? Can you be penalized for negligence? Or in this case, substantial understatement of tax under 6062 for not having put that on the return. Now, that's a question about what could be a problem because, as we said, consistent reporting. But if you fail to report, the problem becomes that Congress a few years ago changed the law to for partnership exams to move most penalty issues into the TEFRA exam at the partnership level. So here's the catch. There was no exam of the partnership, but did Congress foul up by moving the penalty into that? So now there's no way for the service to create the penalty. And that's what the taxpayer was arguing in this case. So in this case, we're going to take a look at, is that correct? Did Congress foul up? The case was Malone versus Commissioner, 148 TC number 16 on May the 1st. As I said, he failed to report items from the partnership, did not file a notice of inconsistent treatment. Simple bottom line, the court decided, you know what, Congress didn't foul up. They didn't mean. There is no partnership exam. When there is no partnership exam and you simply fail to report, the IRS has the right to impose a penalty under 6662 on you. Not a surprising result, but it was a hole, as it's a published decision, it was a hole that the IRS had never really run into before, the tax court never run into directly before. Now we have an answer to say, yeah, they can do that. Again, remember, it's that time of year. Signing up for CPE is running now. And you want to go back, check online with your state societies. Check out the live courses being presented by your state society of CPAs. Those live courses give you a chance to interact with not only the subject matter expert at the front of the room who's giving the course, but also allow you to interact with the other members of the profession in your area. Make a lot of good contacts and find a lot of good connections, especially if you're a sole practitioner, with other people who are in practice in your area. So be sure to consider looking at your state society's website and determining if, you know, what sort of courses you'd like to be taking in the coming year from your state society for your live CPE. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments presented by the Scalzo Institute for the week of May 8th, 2017. Be sure to catch our updates during the week on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that has the articles on all of today's topics in there. If you have any questions or comments, send them to Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Just email me there. You can also follow me on Twitter. I post, whenever I post something, I kick it up to Twitter as well. So you can follow me there. My handle there is at Ed Zollers. Well, have fun this week. Take care. And we look forward to seeing you next week when we talk about what the IRS, the courts, and, well, Congress is out of town. They won't do anything. May be doing with regard to federal taxes.